is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. He's a figure known simultaneously for his efforts to reform the conservative kingdom and for his brutal methods. Just think the notorious murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Mohammed bin Salman, commonly referred to as MBS, is only 34, but he commands enormous power and evokes much trepidation both within his own country and in the larger Middle East region. What do we really know about him and how he came to power? And what does the future of Saudi look like with him at the wheel? Ben Hubbard is the Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times, and he's the author of a major new biography of bin Salman. It's titled MBS, and it paints an intriguing, sometimes chilling picture of the Saudi Arabian leader, the heavy-handed authoritarianism he employs and all his various manoeuvrings. I'm delighted that Ben could join me this week for some insights. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Ben.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Most listeners, Ben, won't know too much, I don't think, about MBS's background. He wasn't the most likely successor to the throne, for instance. Could you give us a brief outline, please, of how he rose to power?
Well, it's not even most listeners. I think it was one of the things that intrigued me when I began working on this project was how little information there was in the public record about Mohammed bin Salman before 2015, when the previous Saudi monarch, King Abdullah, died and his father became king. And all of a sudden, we have this 29-year-old prince who sort of comes out of nowhere and starts being given tremendous, tremendous power by his father. So I spent a lot of time just trying to track down, okay, who was this guy before he turned 29 and what sort of background did he have? And what's quite interesting is that his background is almost entirely Saudi. In the royal family, obviously, you have many wealthy, many princes, many of whom are wealthy, and many of whom have spent a lot of time various places in the West. You can compare MBS to some of his older half-brothers. He's actually the sixth son of his father. Hmm. And many of his older half-brothers have much, much more impressive resumes. I mean, one of them has a PhD from Oxford. One of them was the first Arab astronaut who flew on the space shuttle Discovery. They have founded investment banks. They have founded, run media companies, people with very, very good resumes who have spent time at foreign universities, speak English fluently. And MBS doesn't have any of that. This was somebody who stayed. His entire youth was in Saudi Arabia. His entire education was in Saudi Arabia, graduated from a local university with a law degree, and then basically worked for his father while he was the governor of Riyadh. And so, this means that his education and his outlook is very, very, very Saudi. He does not really, I think at least when he came to power, really did not have kind of an innate sense for Saudi Arabia's Western allies, the UK, the United States, and other countries, and sort of how they would react to different things that he wanted to do.
So it sounds like, well, A, he took advantage of a vacuum in the succession planning, but secondly, and I'd like you to talk about that, it sounds almost like a Darwinian thing you're describing. He was seriously hungry for power then, was he? And just simply had a very basic approach to grabbing it.
Well, there's kind of a combination of factors that led to, his rise. I mean, one of the sort of main questions I try to answer in the book is, out of all these thousands of princes, why was it him? I mean, why was he the one who ended up on top? And so the first is just luck. So Saudi Arabia was founded in 1932 by King Abdulaziz. All of the subsequent kings have been his sons, and they've gone from oldest to youngest, skipping over a few because they were either deemed, unworthy or because they didn't want to rule. And Salman, who's the current king and MBS's father, is basically the youngest person in that line. There's one other person who was, there and removed. And so we're at this point where, the monarchy of Saudi Arabia needs to jump to the next generation. And there had been this looming challenge of how is that going to happen? So just because of sheer luck, it ended up that Salman, MBS's father, was the last king of that generation to rule. And since he's an absolute monarch, he can really choose anybody that he wants. He could most likely would choose one of his sons, but as I said a minute ago, he skipped over his first five sons and he chose his sixth son, MBS.
There's
a matter of luck to it. Well, a lot of it has to do with just the relationship between them. What you hear from people very close to the entourage is that he just formed this incredibly tight bond with his father. He basically shadowed his father while his father was running the governorship in Riyadh. Became very, very close to him, and his father just had this tremendous trust in him and that they sort of shared an outlook of what they thought needed to be done in Saudi Arabia. So Salman becomes king. He begins bringing MBS up. He makes him the defense minister, puts him in charge of the military very quickly, puts him, on the head of the board, as the head of the board for Saudi Aramco, the Saudi oil monopoly. I mean, we're talking tremendous, tremendous jobs for a 29-year-old who doesn't really have much experience in these kinds of things. And then I think MBS's own qualities or attributes really take over. And this is when we see this just this driving ambition and sometimes ruthlessness, just this ability to sort of elbow other people out of the way to get what he wants and to get where he wants to be.
Is he sophisticated or is he crude in his style?
Well, he's very Saudi, and I've, you know, people who've spent a lot of time with him say that he has this almost earthy quality. You know, Arab leaders, many of them tend to speak this very sort of formalized language, you know, and they, you know, that's to sound very erudite and whatever. He doesn't do any of that. This is a guy who he keeps his beard scruffy. He speaks in this sort of dialect from the center of the Arabian Peninsula. He cuts himself off in the middle of his sentences. His voice is very deep. It almost sounds like a growl. So he doesn't sort of have a lot of that formality. His mind moves very quickly. I mean, this is a guy who's interested in all kinds of things. And I have a number of examples in the book of, you know, people who went to see him for various either business possibilities or things like that and sort of came away amazed about the things that he wanted to talk about, sometimes positively and sometimes because they were sort of amazed. You know, he's interested in all kinds of new technology, interested in what you can do with, you know, some of the people that I talked to said they met with him and he was suddenly interested in biotech and was saying, you know, do you realize that in a few decades we could have a pill that you could take that will use artificial intelligence to diagnose what's wrong with your body and fix it from the inside? And these guys kind of came away scratching their heads being like, wow, is he sort of pondering the possibility of eternal life? You know, but there's other things. He's interested in self-driving cars. He's interested in drones. He's interested in, you know, all of these various kinds of technology. And so, you know, this has obviously led to a lot of criticisms that a lot of what he wants to do seems very pie in the sky.
How fascinating. What does he think of the West, by the way?
Well, he loves the West. I mean, he loves the West in that, not that he wants to emulate it or that he wants to necessarily make Saudi Arabia a carbon copy of the West, but he definitely sees a lot of value in what's happening in the West, I think particularly in terms of culture and technology. And he's made great efforts to build ties there. 2018, he took this massive visit both to the UK and to the United States. He went to, you know, in the UK, he met with the Queen, he met with the heads of MI5, MI6, you know, he met with all of these people. Then he goes to the United States on this remarkable trip. He goes to five states, the District of Columbia, meets with three former presidents, meets with Trump in the White House, goes to Silicon Valley, goes to Hollywood. I mean, and he, you know, it was just a very clear indication that there's a lot that he wanted to import from the United States. He wanted to bring culture, entertainment. He wanted to bring the tech sector. And he was very interested in bringing them all to Saudi Arabia because he saw them all as assets for some of the things that he wanted to do. Unfortunately, because of the way that things have gone, many of these people now want to keep their distance from him because they think he's a bit dangerous or they don't like some of the things that his government has done.
I'm going to come to that. But like, he has this Vision 2030, doesn't he? Grand plans for the kingdom. And I'd like you to just, well, you've alluded to it, but, you know, are we finding out that it's got depth? They've got depth or is it all rhetoric and pie in the sky?
Well, I think it depends. You have to sort of break it down. Vision 2030, he launched quite early during his rise and worked on it for a very long time with a number of, you know, all these Western consultants were sort of tapped to put this thing together and study the Saudi economy, Saudi society, what needs to change and how. And the largest piece of it is economic. And the idea is basically that Saudi Arabia cannot remain so dependent on oil revenues. They need to diversify the economy. And so they come up with a number of ways this is going to happen. They need to get more Saudis, you know, out of working for the government and into working for the private sector. And then there's kind of a whole social aspect to it, too. He wants there to be entertainment. He wants entertainment to boom. So he's, you know, open movie theaters, concert venues. They want to build amusement parks and, you know, all these things that Saudi Arabia didn't have because of its historically very austere interpretation of Islam that kept a lot of these things out. I mean, it goes down to, you know, new regulations for women, what women can wear, where women can work. He, you know, lifted the ban on women driving. And so, you know, I think when you're going to look at Vision 2030, there's a lot in the social side of it that I think has been so far at least quite successful. You know, I think he's legitimately interested in these things. I think on the economic side, the challenges are massive and, you know, only time will tell how much he's going to be able to pull these things off. But diversifying.
As a matter of interest, is income tax levied there? Because I know in a lot of the Middle East countries, there's no income tax, for instance, and they're having a lot of trouble trying to bring it in. Now, is it levied?
No, there's definitely never been any never been any income tax in Saudi Arabia. They did recently institute a VAT tax, which, you know, there was a good amount of grumbling over that, and they've at various times tried to reduce subsidies, but Saudi Arabia has huge amounts of money thanks to its oil income. And historically, basically, they had what some people refer to as a waterfall economy, that the sort of the money would come out at the top to the king, to the princes, and they would sort of rain it down on the rest of the society. And just one useful metric of this is that 2/3 of employed Saudis are employed by the government. Like 2/3 of all the Saudis who actually have a job work for the government. And, you know, the other third are sort of in the private sector. But even the private sector in Saudi Arabia is incredibly dependent on the government. They do government contracts, they service various things for the government. And so it's a very, very centralized economy in terms of where the revenue comes from. And this is something that he realizes not going to last. The population is too large. There are way too many young people. Out of Saudi Arabia's 22 million people, about 2/3 of them are under age 30. There are hundreds of thousands of them entering the job market every year looking for jobs, and the government just doesn't have the money anymore to employ them all. So there's really a lot that needs to change in the Saudi economy, and the big question is how effectively he's going to be able to do these things.
Let me tell listeners that Ben Hubbard, I'm delighted to say, is joining us. He is the Beirut Bureau Chief of the New York Times, and he's written this book, MBS, a biography of Mohammed bin Salman. Now, his plans do include, as you say, opening up Saudi Arabian society, bringing women into the workplace, reducing the power of the clergy. But this has been a bit of a stop-go experience. I mean, there's one story, for instance, which really was quite something. Roger Cohen, the New York Times columnist that I think a lot of Australians followed, interviewed just after the driving ban was listed, interviewed Hatun Al-Fassi, a scholar of women's history who knew a lot about Saudi women. And he summarised her take on MBS like this. The Crown Prince is genuine. He's put his finger on what is keeping Saudi Arabia back. He lacks wisdom, especially on Qatar. There are lots of red lines. The centralisation of power is alarming. Changes have occurred, but have not been framed in law, which makes them vulnerable. I am hopeful, Al-Fassi told Cohen, hopeful that 10 years from now we'll have a public sphere that is more humane and safe for women. She was arrested soon afterward, you say. So, you know, is that the tenor of what's happening? One step forward and three steps back.
So the largest thing missing from Vision 2030, if you really want to remake a country, is any talk of any kind of political reform. And so people have used the term from Mohammed bin Salman, you know, saying he's a liberalizer, he's a reformer. And I think that's true on the economic sense. I think it's true on the social sense. It is 100% not true on the political sense. This guy has never talked about democratization. He's never talked about finding ways to integrate citizens into decision making or allowing them to choose their own representatives or their own leaders. He's very much an authoritarian. And I think he's following the model of, you know, China, following the model of Singapore, following the model of the United Arab Emirates next door to Saudi Arabia, this idea that if change is going to come, we need to have absolute control over our society and we're going to do what we think is best. It's almost this kind of enlightened autocrat view of things. And so what this has meant is that there's been a massive crackdown on any kind of dissent, and not even dissent, but even just people saying things. I mean, Hatun Al-Fassi was not a dissident. She was a very well-respected scholar. I mean, I used to call her all the time when I was writing stories about Saudi women and I needed an expert to sort of fill me in on things. And, you know, as you know, the passage that you just read is quite complimentary to Mohammed bin Salman, and she ended up getting put in jail for it for a while.
So was Khashoggi. I mean, that was the thing about Khashoggi, from what I read at the time, that he'd actually been very much on song with where he thought MBS was trying to take the society, and then hinted, tell me if I'm wrong at any point, sort of more or less hinted that he was changing his mind a bit, and then bang, you know, he's dismembered in a Turkish embassy.
Yeah, Jamal Khashoggi is definitely the most drastic example of this. So just to give your listeners a little bit of background, this guy was a household name in Saudi Arabia for many, many decades as part of the establishment. I mean, he was effectively a government journalist. He, you know, by the time he was killed, he was in his late 50s. But for many, many decades, he was, you know, one of the leading lights of Saudi society and Saudi media. People knew who he was. He was on TV. He was talking to the Western media. And he was incredibly useful for people like me because Saudi Arabia can be a confusing place. It's hard to tell what's going on. And so for a very long time, he was just one of the first people I would call when something happened in Saudi Arabia. And he could be counted on to tell you, oh, this is what I think the king is thinking, and this is what I think the government is doing, and this is how Saudi Arabia sees this particular issue. And the breakdown between him and MBS actually comes originally as a result of Donald Trump. Basically, when Donald Trump won the election in 2016, the Saudis, they had a brief crisis and sort of realized, like, oh my God, we have no relationship with this person, and the United States is our most important ally. What are we going to do? We need to start courting them. We need to figure out who this administration is, because we need to have a relationship with them. And Jamal didn't really like Donald Trump. He criticized him quite a lot on social media for a number of the, you know, quite nasty things he had, that Trump had said about Muslims and specifically about the Saudis. He wrote a column telling Saudis, you know, we don't need to be scared of Trump, but we need to prepare for him. Jamal very quickly received a call from one of MBS's assistants at the royal court telling him, you're done. No more social media, no more going on television, no more publication. And so he entered this period of silence. And then it was during that time he really saw that the winds were changing in Saudi Arabia. He packed his bags and he left and ended up living outside of Washington, D.C. and began writing for The Washington Post. And this is when he really became a critic. He began publishing frequently in The Washington Post. And he was complimentary about a lot of the social things and said, yes, these are things that need to be done and have needed to be done for a long time. But was very, very critical about the authoritarian side of how MBS was running the country. And so I think that's one of the things that angered them. And it was also the fact that he had been inside the house. He was part of the establishment. And so, yes, you know, to go from where he was to being, you know, this dissident who's not only criticizing the Crown Prince, but doing it in the capital of the United States, in a publication like the Washington Post, I think they just saw this as a betrayal.
Was he taken aback by the shockwaves that the Khashoggi murder caused, and whether it's affected his standing internally or externally, and does he care about either?
Well, I think he definitely cares about his international standing, and I think that he has been shocked by kind of the amount of blowback that he received from Khashoggi. I think that there was, in a way, a lot of anger, just feeling that, like, you know, why is everybody so against me for doing this? I'm doing what I need to do for my country, and you know, this guy was causing problems. And I just don't think he quite, you know, and it could be because of this deep Saudi background that he had, that he had not sort of spent time in the West. He didn't really seem to be able to anticipate how this was going to go over. But there was, yeah, there was very much this sense of, why have all these people turned on me?
Because if in the Middle East, the attitude towards the Saudi family is particularly poor. I've struck it both in Jordan and in Lebanon. They're not well regarded. That's been my experience, just in terms of their general image to people from the Gulf.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you ask. But yeah, I think in general, there's you know, kind of a mix of jealousy that, you know, these people who they have this tremendous, tremendous wealth that they didn't really do anything to earn. I think there's certainly jealousy around that level. And then, you know, then there's, you know, people who oppose them politically are angry at how they can use that kind of wealth to have political influence in different parts of the region. And then also the ways that they've used that money to kind of spread their very austere interpretation of Islam around the region. That's also angered a lot of people who think this has been a destructive force in the Middle East and beyond.
Now, Ben, you start the book wondering if you, as a longtime reporter reporting on Saudi Arabia, might be a target. And there are signs that you're being monitored. Your own phone has been hacked. I mean, how do you navigate this threat?
Look, I don't want to overstate the case of any potential threat to me. I mean, any threat that I may face as an American journalist writing about Saudi Arabia is minuscule compared to what Saudi dissidents face, or even just Saudis, you know, inside the kingdom who choose to express themselves on social media or in any way publicly. So, I mean, I put it in the book basically because everybody that I, or many, many people that I interviewed while I was working on it, every time I said, hey, I'm doing a book about MBS, they would say, aren't you scared for your personal safety? And so I felt like I needed to address that and say, yeah, it was something that I thought about. I was working on the book right in the aftermath of the murder of Khashoggi, which really, yeah, I think a lot of us felt changed the rules. I mean, nobody thought that something like this was possible before. And then you start wondering, wow, if they can do that, if they can dispatch 15 agents to a foreign country, get someone inside of a consulate, kill him, chop him into pieces, make his body disappear, what else are they capable of? So, you know, it's something that I thought about. And in terms of the hacking attempt, there were, you know, the Saudis, one thing that MBS did during his rise is he recognized the power that technology could give him to consolidate his control. And so there was a lot of effort and a lot of money invested in ways to manipulate social media inside the kingdom to sort of amplify conversations that were positive about him and to dilute conversations that were negative. Then there was a much more kind of hands-on going after people who were criticizing him on social media. A number of these people were arrested or, you know, things like that. And then they've also invested a bunch of money in hacking technologies. There was a whole wave of hacks that researchers have traced back to the Saudis in the middle of 2018. And I was targeted. I received a text message on my phone that struck me right away as suspicious. I had a strange URL and a strange message. I did not click on it and just kind of ignored it. And then a number of months later, spoke with some technology researchers who were pulling these together, and they inspected it and said, yeah, we have every reason to believe that you were targeted by the Saudis.
Wow. And in fact, just finally, you do end your book on the story of your friend who has basically distanced himself from you now, a Saudi man. That does suggest that there is, the situation has altered in Saudi Arabia. The power shift is having ramifications.
Yeah, and it is sad for me. I mean, I enjoyed Saudi Arabia. It was not an easy place to work. It's a difficult place to get people to talk. It's a difficult place to understand what's going on. But I did spend a lot of time there over, you know, this 5-6 years that I was, you know, working on it and reporting on it and then working on the book. And I made a lot of friends. There were a lot of Saudis that I really appreciated, a lot of people that were very intelligent and curious about the world and that I would love getting together and discussing things with. And you know, as this kind of authoritarian crackdown ramped up, a lot of these people distanced themselves and either said like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't message me, or let's not talk on the phone, let's message on this encrypted app. And a few people that I had considered quite good friends that I used to have dinner with or things like that have just blocked me altogether, I think for their own safety. And so, you know, that's part of the reality of being a journalist, you know, working on a country like Saudi Arabia. So, you know, just, you know, that your contacts and people that you meet, at the end of the day, they have to look out for themselves. And so I don't take any of it personally. But it is quite sad because I met a lot of people that I liked and I wish that I could still be in touch with them.
Well, Ben, we'll see just how much more powerful he does or doesn't become. And of course, he's hosting the G20 meeting, it would appear, the special meeting for the COVID virus discussion in Riyadh in weeks to come. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ben Hubbard there. And Ben is Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times. His book is entitled MBS, and it's out now from HarperCollins.